A recent report makes an economic argument for keeping 17-year-olds out of adult courts here in Wisconsin.
A spate of tough-on-crime laws from the 1990s resulted in changes to Wisconsin law, and today 17-year-olds are tried as adults in Wisconsin, which can be a costly process for the offender and for taxpayers.
The report looks at factors including a person's likelihood to recommit a crime, the growth of criminal justice spending, and other costs of putting juveniles in adult court.
Joining us now to talk about that report is one of its authors, Ola Lisowski. She's a research associate for the John K. MacIver Institute for Public Policy. Ola, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Well, when people advocate to move 17-year-olds into juvenile court, they usually say that the process of putting them in adult courts is unfair and that maybe it opens them up to risk an assault. But you're making the case here, this report is making the case, that's an economic one for trying 17-year-olds in juvenile court. Why?
When we look at trying nonviolent 17-year-olds as adults compared to trying them as juveniles, it does turn out to be much more expensive, and that's when we look at recidivism. So, in other words, when a nonviolent 17-year-old leaves prison, what's the likeliness that he or she will end up back in prison? In Wisconsin, according to the Legislative Audit Bureau, we know that a 17-year-old tried in the adult system is actually three times more likely to end up back in the system compared to somebody who started off in the juvenile system. So we have to ask ourselves, with numbers like these, what are we doing wrong? And are there any alternatives that are not only more cost-effective, but actually produce better results for our youth and our communities?
And according to these findings, do we know just how much Wisconsin could save by putting more 17-year-olds, nonviolent 17-year-olds, in the juvenile court system?
So that's actually a bit of a point of contention right now. So the counties have estimated that it would take several millions of dollars. Other groups, such as the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families, say that the counties are actually overestimating that price tag by a lot, and that it would only cost a couple million dollars up front. So that's not something that we have a hard and fast number for, but by looking at the experience of other states, we do know unequivocally that moving younger offenders, even just the nonviolent ones, would save the state money in the end. We saw this pretty close to home in Minnesota, where youth tried as adults were 16% more likely to reoffend than those tried in the juvenile system. And the same is true in Illinois, which raised the age of juvenile court jurisdiction to 18 back in 2009. They had that same argument down there, which was, will this cause our crime rates to go up and for public safety to go down? A couple years later, we know that those things did not happen and that the state actually was able to close up three juvenile facilities because of low occupancy. Texas is another state, a more conservative state, that was looking at making this change. The National Conservative Movement for Criminal Justice Reform is basically headed up out of Texas with Right on Crime and the Texas Public Policy Foundation, which, of course, co-authored our report. There in Texas, researchers at UT Austin found that raising the age of juvenile jurisdiction to 17 would have a net benefit of almost $89 million for each cohort of 17-year-olds. So this is a lot of money. It would turn out to be a lot in the end that we would save, even though it would be a bit more upfront.
So looking strictly at the laws on the books surrounding this in Wisconsin, how does Wisconsin compare with the laws that other states have?
Well, so Wisconsin right now is right now there are 41 states, as well as Washington, D.C., that hold the upper boundary of the juvenile court's jurisdiction at 17. Wisconsin is one of seven states that draw the boundary at 16, and there are actually two states that have it at 15. So we are one of the few left that are still automatically charging our 17-year-olds as adults.
And as I understand it, Wisconsin also has the once-waived, always-waived provision for youth 14 years and older. How does that work?
So that kind of depends on the scenario. In very, very serious circumstances, such as the Slenderman case from a couple of years ago, youth that young can be transferred into the adult system, depending on the type of crime. So what we're asking in this report, we're really just kind of looking at, the older age of the spectrum, those nonviolent first-time 17-year-old offenders, and saying, look, in this area, is there something that we can do better? And looking at the experience of other states, we think that we can.
Well, to look at where laws like this came from, can you put that into a little bit of historical context about when these laws first appeared on Wisconsin books?
Sure. So back in the mid-90s, 1995, we saw a wave of crime across the country. And so that spurred this kind of tough-on-crime movement where the thinking was, let's raise penalties to deter criminals, increase mandatory minimum sentences, and go after 17-year-olds who should know better, and the crime rate will go down. So in some ways, that ended up being true, but since the mid-90s, crime rates have fallen not only in Wisconsin, but actually across the country. So right now, we're in a situation where we see these big government programs where the number of juveniles arrested has fallen by more than half, but at the same time, we're spending more money to house them. What we've seen, if you look at since 2009, if you look at per juvenile arrest, the counties get almost 50% more funding per juvenile getting arrested. So we have to ask ourselves, is this the best idea out there, and are we doing this as effectively as we can?
We're talking with Ola Laskowski right now from the John K. MacIver Institute for Public Policy, talking about the possible economic benefits of keeping 17-year-old offenders out of adult courts. And one thing that critics of this idea have said before is that, you know, the people in question here may not be getting the right punishment, that the system might end up going easy on them. What do you say to that?
You know, again, it depends on who you talk to. So I bring up this point in my report, but in the juvenile system, parents and schools play a much more significant role, whereas in the adult system, they don't even require that parents are notified if their 17-year-old is arrested. So rather than thinking about this as, are we being tough enough or are we spending enough money, we need to ask, are we being effective with our tax dollars? You know, from our perspective as defenders of the free market, we've really got to work hard to scrutinize public dollars that are spent. And we have to ask that question, are we doing the best job that we can, given the money that we have to spend? And, you know, I think you'll see if you look at other states and their experiences, we can do better and get better results, not only for our youth and for our communities, but for our taxpayers as well. So that's why I'm a big fan of the name Right on Crime. You know, it's kind of taking over the tough-on-crime language and saying, no, it's not about being tough or about spending the most money. It's about being right and correct and doing it the right way.
So looking at why those who go through the adult system, 17-year-olds who go through the adult system are more likely to reoffend, what do we know about how the juvenile system works and the resources there that might be keeping people from reoffending?
In the juvenile system, it really just works a bit differently. There are a lot more what they call wraparound services. Like I said, they involve the parents more. There are more restrictions there, more counseling, et cetera. You know, you have these troubled youths. They're committing crimes starting at a young age. And you have to think about if you're putting them in a bad situation with adult offenders, I mean, what's going to happen there? You know, what kind of people are they surrounded by? Are those people good influences? And then there's also the huge question of the safety of these 17-year-olds. You know, there are some, I focus on the economic argument in my report, but we do have some safety numbers in there where, you know, one study found youths are 36 times more likely to commit suicide in an adult jail than a juvenile facility. So, you know, you really just have to look at those numbers and you have to ask, is there a better way to do this?
Now, this is a growing field, the science data here, but your report also looks into the development of adolescent brains. And what did you find there and how that might factor into this discussion?
Yeah, so what we do know there, basically since the 90s, we have had quite a bit more neurobiological research that has furthered our understanding of juvenile brains. And actually, the development of magnetic resonance imaging. That has allowed researchers to view images of the brain throughout different stages of development. So now, since this since these changes were made, we know a lot more about the prefrontal cortex, the area of the brain that controls impulsive behavior and rational thought. We know now that that's not fully developed until people are in their early 20s. Why is that significant from a policy standpoint? Well, you know, the Supreme Court actually answered that question in 2005. When they ruled it to be unconstitutional to use the death penalty on an offender under the age of 18, saying that they actually relied upon the neurobiological research there and cited it in their decision.
Ola, thank you so much for joining us today.
All right. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
That was Ola Lasowski, a research associate at the John K. McIver Institute for Public Policy. She joined us to talk about the economic benefits of trying 17-year-olds as juveniles rather than adults.